Gramsci, the slogan that he made famous was pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. We have to look at the world reasonably, without illusions. That's pessimism of the intellect. At the same time, we recognize there are ways out. So we have optimism of the will, meaning we dedicate ourselves to using all the opportunities that are available and move towards a more just, decent world.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on optimism of the will. How to be positive in these perilous times. Humankind and the planet are facing enormous dangers. We can indulge in magical thinking and hope for miracles, or we can ground ourselves in reality, understand the depth of the crises we face, and then act to change things. It won't be easy. There are huge obstacles and difficulties. Our task going forward is to find kindred spirits, organize, and work to create a decent future. We may be inspired by the adage, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. It was made famous by the great 20th century Italian Marxist thinker and writer Antonio Gramsci. A dedicated anti-fascist, Gramsci languished for 11 years in Mussolini's jails, where his health deteriorated. He died in 1937. Today, there's a revival of interest in Gramsci and his work. In the Gramscian tradition of speaking truth to power is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist. He's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Chris Hedges says, he's America's greatest intellectual who makes the powerful, as well as their liberal apologists, deeply uncomfortable. Author of scores of books, Chomsky's latest are Consequences of Capitalism and Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal. I talked with him on December 9th, just 2 days after his 93rd birthday. He was at his home in Arizona. What we are facing is often described as unprecedented, a pandemic, climate catastrophe, an always lurking off center stage, nuclear annihilation. Three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Well, I can add a fourth, the impending destruction of what remains of American democracy. And the shift of the United States towards a deeply authoritarian, possibly proto-fascist state when the Republicans come back into office, which looks likely. So that's four horses. And that has a big effect on the world and on the other three. Remember that the Republicans are the denialist party, the party that is committed to racing to climate destruction with abandon as quickly as possible into the hands of the chief wrecker, who they now worship like a demigod. It's bad news for the United States and for the world, given US power.
The Swedish International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance annual report just came out on the global state of democracy. It says that the United States is a country where democracy is, quote, backsliding, unquote.
Very severely, the Republican Party is openly dedicated, not even concealed, to undermining what remains of American democracy, and they're working very hard on it. There's a very, quite an interesting article by Barton Gellman in the Current Atlantic, which runs through a lot of the details, worth reading carefully. He's a highly credible commentator. What he thinks is, what he's doing, I think, is correct. The Republicans have long understood back to Nixon, that they're fundamentally a minority party. They're not going to be able to get votes by advertising their increasingly open commitment to the welfare of the ultra-rich in the corporate sector. So they've been diverting attention to other issues as much as they can, so-called cultural issues. Began with Nixon's Southern strategy. Nixon realized, as apparently LBJ had as well, that with limited Democratic support for civil rights legislation, they would lose Southern Democrats, who were openly and overtly extreme racists. The Nixon administration capitalized on that with their Southern strategy, hinting, not so subtly, that the Republicans would become the party of white supremacy. Subsequent years, they picked up other issues, but it's now the virtual definition of the party. So let's run on critical race theory, whatever that means. A cover term, as their leading spokesmen have explained, for everything that we can rally the public on. White supremacy, racism, misogyny, Christianity, abortion rights, whatever we can pick up, we'll mobilize people on that. Meanwhile, at the same time, the leadership, with the aid of the right-wing Federalist Society, has been developing legal, if you want to call it, means for the Republicans to ensure that as a minority party, they will nevertheless be able to control the voting apparatus and the outcome of elections, exploiting the radically undemocratic features that are built into the constitutional system and the structural advantages that Republicans will have as a party representing more scattered rural populations, more traditionally Christian, white nationalist, and even with a minority of the vote using these advantages, they should be able to maintain something like almost permanent power. Actually, the permanence won't be long. If Trump comes back into office or a Trump clone in 2024, it's not very likely that the United States and, in fact, the world will be able to escape the impact of the climate destruction, environmental destruction that they are committed to accelerating. It's not an attractive prospect. Now, there's a short-term Republican strategy which is working very well. Now, that is, as has been made explicit by Mitch McConnell and others, make the country ungovernable. Same policy they played when a couple of years when Obama had control. Make the country ungovernable, meaning harm it as much as possible, blame the Democrats, come back into office, then put in motion the devices that are carefully being planned to ensure that the structures of American democracy will erode and this organization, which is no longer a political party in any traditional sense, will be able to gain permanent power, something like it, and bring back again the wrecker-in-chief who they crawl to Mar-a-Lago to go for his blessings in a display of cowardice that is almost beyond description. Well, that's what's happening before our eyes. So today, the Republicans managed to kill Biden's program to institute testing or mandates or vaccination at businesses with 500 employees. That's a perfect way to increase the pandemic, which is raging, harm the population, crush more hospitals with unvaccinated patients, shriek about liberty, which they don't believe in for a minute, and make the country suffer. And then you can blame it on the Democrats. Same with everything else, the limited climate change components of the legislative proposals have been pretty much killed. Other things have been attenuated to the point where even if it passes the next one, which is unlikely, it will not do enough, certainly in the short term, to give any indication that the Democrats or the government can do anything for the population. So you can arouse the voting base on the with the kinds of appeals that they have honed into devices to mislead, control, direct attention away from real issues to the so-called cultural issues that they would like to hold in the forefront as they proceed to undermine the economy, harm the population, ensure short-term profit for their masters in the corporate sector. That's what we're facing.
We all saw what happened in Washington on January 6th. Do you see the possibility of civil unrest spreading in the United States? There are multiple militias all across the country. Representative Paul Gosar of the great state of Arizona, Representative Lauren Boebert of the great state of Colorado, among others, have made threatening statements inciting violence and hatred. The internet is crawling with conspiracy theories.
It is very serious. In fact, I think maybe a third or so of Republicans think it may be necessary to use force to save our country, as they put it. Save our country has a clear meaning. If anyone didn't understand it, Trump issued a call to people to mobilize to prevent the Democrats from swamping the country with criminals who are being let out of jails in other countries so the Democrats can pour them across the border, as is now happening, to replace white Americans, the great replacement, and to carry out the destruction of America, mobilized to stop that. And that's what take away our country means. And it's being used very effectively by the proto-fascist elements, Trump being the most extreme and the most successful. What can we do about it? The only tools available, like it or not, are education and organization. There's no other way. It means trying to revive a real, authentic labor movement of the kind that has existed in the past and been in the forefront of moves towards social justice, organizing other popular movements, carrying out widespread educational efforts to combat the brutal, murderous anti-vaccine campaigns that are going on, make sure that there are serious efforts to deal with the climate crisis, mobilize against the bipartisan agreement to increase dangerous military spending, increase provocative actions against China, which could lead to a conflict that nobody wants and could end up into a terminal war. Just have to keep working on this, nothing else. There are people doing it, plenty, and their efforts have to be expanded, more support, more dedication, no other way to do it.
But time is not on our side.
Doesn't matter. Whatever opportunities they are, we take them. They do exist. We can lament the fact that the stars are not aligned properly, but the only way to do that is by further dedicated engagement and careful thinking about how to structure it and frame it so that it prevents the efforts to exploit phrases, terms by the cynical Republican effort to carry out the project they're committed to. Have to ensure not to help that out by bad tactics, by ill-chosen terminology, recognize that the people being caught up in this are human beings who can be reached and must be reached if we're going to survive.
In the background, of course, is the extreme inequality of the United States, just off the charts. Why is the U.S. so unequal?
Well, it goes back a long way. A lot of this has happened just in the last 40 years as part of the neoliberal assault on the general population, in which the Democrats have participated as well, not to the extent of the Republican organization, but the Democrats have also played their role. This has had a major impact. There is a fairly careful estimate of the what's called the transfer of wealth from the lower 90% of the population to the top 1%, actually a fraction of them, during the 40 years of this assault. A Rand Corporation study, which estimated it at close to $50 trillion. It's not pennies, and it's ongoing. During the pandemic, the measures that were taken to save the economy from collapse did lead to further enrichment of the very few, sort of maintained life for the others, but the Republicans are busy trying to dismantle that part of it, leave only the part that enriches the very few. That's their dedication. The Republicans have red lines that they've imposed on any potential legislation. Take a look at these, they're very telling. For the Republicans, there are two red lines. One, you cannot touch Trump's tax cut, a tax cut which was a complete scam, was a huge benefit for the very rich and the corporate sector, stabbed everyone else in the back. Can't touch that. That's fixed. Second thing you can't touch is funding the Internal Revenue Service. Can't fund the IRS because its task will be to stop massive tax cheating by the super rich. And we have to permit that to continue. That's a red line for the Republicans. The very rich have to be permitted to cheat and rob as much as possible. So that means let's move as quickly as possible to destroy the environment for the benefit of the fossil fuel industry so they can make as much profit as possible before we all go under. And the banks that fund them and the military, which is pouring pollution into the atmosphere at the level of maybe 150 or so middle-income countries, has got to continue with this because nothing is more important than the profits of the very few and the very rich. Those are the red lines, and they show up in other ways as well. So take what goes on secretly, quietly in the background. Take ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. This is goes back years, organization funded by almost the entire corporate sector, which is dedicated to hit at the weak point in the constitutional system, the states. It's very easy, doesn't take much to buy or impel a legislative representative at the state level to follow legislation you're writing. So what ALEC has been doing is working at the state level to impose legislation which will foster the long-term efforts of those who are seeking to destroy democracy, to increase radical inequality, to destroy the environment. Let's act at the state level to establish legislation which will implement their efforts, foster and advance their efforts. And one of them, one of the most important, is legislate, get the states to legislate, not to even investigate certainly not to punish wage theft. Wage theft is a business practice which steals billions of dollars from workers every year by refusing to pay overtime, by other devices. There have been efforts to investigate it, but the business sector wants to stop them. ALEC is getting the states to pass legislation not to punish it and not even to investigate it. That's the state level analog of ensuring that the IRS not go after wealthy corporate tax cheats. At every level you can think of, this class war is raging with intensity on the part of the masters, the corporate sector, the super rich, and they're going to use every means they can to ensure that it goes on as long as possible until they've succeeded in destroying not only American democracy, but the possibility for survival of organized society. That's what's going on before our eyes. Human species has never faced a moment like this. And we have faced moments when democracy was collapsing. 1930s was one in Europe where it did collapse, moved to fascism, while the US moved to social democracy. Now it's kind of reversing. We have never had moments when the destruction of organized human society was a likely prospect and not in the long-term distance. That's new. And if that isn't dealt with, nothing else matters.
Corporate power seems unstoppable. The Uber class of gazillionaires, Bezos, Branson, and Musk, are flying into outer space. But I'm reminded of something that the novelist Ursula Le Guin said some years ago. She said, "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable." And then she adds, "So did the divine right of kings."
So was slavery. So was the principle that women are property, formerly lasted in the United States until the 1970s. So were laws against miscegenation, so extreme that the Nazis wouldn't accept them, lasted in the United States till the 1960s. So was vicious, murderous slavery. All kind of horrors existed. Over time, their power has been eroded. It's never completely disappeared. Slavery was abolished, but its remnants remain in new and vicious forms. It's not slavery, but it's horrifying enough. The idea that women are not persons has been formally overcome and overcome in practice to a substantial extent, but there's plenty to do. The constitutional system was a step forward in the 18th century. Even the phrase, "we the people," terrified the autocratic rulers of Europe. Metternich, the Tsar, who deeply concerned that the evils of democracy, what was called republicanism then, could spread and undermine civilized life. Well, did spread, and civilized life continued, even improved. So, yes, there are periods of regression, there's progress. The class war never ends. The masters never relent, always looking for every opportunity. If they're the only participants, we will have regression. But they don't have to be any more than in the past, as in the eloquent quote that you just gave.
In your Masters of Mankind essay, "Can Civilization Survive Really Existing Capitalism?" you write, "Really existing capitalist democracy, RECD for short, pronounced RECT, is radically incompatible with democracy. It seems to me," you're writing, "it seems to me unlikely that civilization can survive really existing capitalism and the sharply attenuated democracy that goes along with it. Could functioning democracy make a difference, you ask? Consideration of non-existent systems can only be speculative, but I think there's some reason to think so. Tell me your reasons.
Well, first of all, we live in this world, not in some world we'd like to imagine. And in this world, if you simply think about the time scale for dealing with environmental destruction is far shorter than the time that would be necessary to carry out significant reshaping of basic institutions. It doesn't mean you have to abandon the attempt to do that. In fact, you should be doing it all the time, should be working on ways to raise consciousness, raise understanding, build the rudiments of future institutions in the present society. All of that is an ongoing campaign. At the same time, the measures to save us from self-destruction will have to take place within the basic framework of existing institutions, some modification of them, but without fundamental change. And it can be done. We know how it can be done. There are careful, credible studies, one of the best by my co-author, economist Robert Pollan, great detail, another by Jeffrey Sachs, fine economist using other models, others by the International Energy Agency, which has its roots in corporate America, all pretty much the same. There's a resolution in Congress, recently reinitiated by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey, laying out in extensive detail programs of essentially the same sort. They can be implemented easily within the range of expenditures that are easily tolerable by the economy, by the general economy, perfectly feasible, can be carried out within existing institutions. Task is to make sure that's done. Meanwhile, work on overcoming the problem of wrecked, really existing capitalist democracy, which in its basic nature is a death sentence and also deeply inhuman in its fundamental properties. So let's work on that and at the same time ensure that we save the possibility of achieving it by overcoming the immediate and urgent crisis, as can be done within basically the framework of existing institutions. Those are the dilemmas that we face.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky, Optimism of the Will. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and Chomsky's latest books, Consequences of Capitalism and Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. Well, you and I are, and others are often accused of just talking about gloom and doom. But here are a couple of items that are quite upbeat and positive. The first one being what happened in India, where thousands of Indian farmers from Punjab and neighboring states encamped outside of Delhi. And after a year-long struggle, forced the Narendra Modi BJP Hindu nationalist regime to roll back three agricultural laws which would have reduced farmers to a semi-serf status. Vijay Prashad called these proposed laws the uberization of farmers, turning them into gig workers. Modi may at some point try and repackage the laws and reintroduce them, but for now, it's a victory of some sort. The other upbeat piece of news is Honduras and the election of Xiomara Castro as president, the first woman to hold that post. She replaces a corrupt right-wing regime that had ruled for 12 years. She's described as a democratic socialist. She's the wife of Manuel Zelaya. He was president, but was overthrown in a coup in 2009. A coup, by the way, correct me if I'm mistaken, that was backed by Washington. So talk about those two examples.
Can I add a third one? I think yesterday, Lula announced his presidency campaign for Brazil, which he's running way above Bolsonaro in the polls, could lead to a reversal of the move towards proto-fascism in the second largest country in the hemisphere. These two things that you mentioned are major victories. The farmer strike in India was an astonishing development. These are farmers who have suffered severely through the neoliberal period. The support systems for the rural agriculture have been undermined. Rural development programs, research programs, the system has been redesigned so that farming life is so painful and difficult that suicides have been rising sharply as farmers just give up hope. The numbers are appalling. This has been going on for years, ever since the neoliberal rules were imposed. The farmers finally rose up with the latest effort of the Modi government to really, as Vijay Prashad said, to basically turn them into barely surviving serfs. They rose up, huge numbers, massive strike, withstood violence and repression, couldn't be beaten down, stayed there persistent over a year, finally won. The government backed down. Very right-wing government, has a lot of voting support, but it had to back down. That's of extreme importance. It's deeply encouraging. Shows what the people can do when they refuse to be servants of the masters. Honduras has a hideous history way back. It's the prototypical so-called banana republic run by a dozen or so rich families, awful conditions for most of the population. During the 1980s, it was the US military base for the Reagan's terrorist wars in Central America. Plenty of repression in Honduras as well. Finally, a moderately reformist candidate appeared, Mel Zelaya, a conservative from the conservative movement, but had some moderately reformist efforts. The ruling class came down on him like a ton of bricks. He was forced out of office, expelled from the country, harshly condemned by almost all of Latin America, most of the world, with the exception of Obama and Clinton, who gave it a kind of a light tap on the wrist, but refused to call it a military coup, which it obviously was, because if they'd called it a military coup, they would have had to withdraw US military support for the ruling junta, which was destroying Honduran democracy. And they didn't want to do that, so it wasn't a coup. And that led to a real increase, sharp increase in the Honduran horror story. It became basically the murder capital of the world, was the sort people began to flee in desperation, was the source of the caravans that the US government tried to block or to get other countries to block so they wouldn't reach our border. And they were have been the plurality of people fleeing from Central America. What Trump in his recent pronouncement called the criminals who the Democrats are mobilizing to attack the white race and destroy it. Well, that's Honduras. The ruling junta did then carry out an election which was ridiculed virtually everywhere except in Washington, where Obama and Clinton praised the military junta for their promising steps towards democracy. Then turned, apart from all the other crimes, turned into one of the major narco-trafficking centers. Now, as you say, population did manage to elect Mel Zelaya's wife, who might be able to carry out the mild reforms that he was beginning to initiate. There'll be plenty of roadblocks, the same internal forces that overthrew him and drove him into exile, the same US forces which have backed them, and have done it for a long time, increasingly in the way I described in recent years. And it's up to us to ensure that that's not overturned. Could be, there's going to be a battle. Similar ones are taking place elsewhere, Peru, Colombia, Brazil, all the areas that are our so-called backyard, Haiti. In all of these countries, we have an overwhelming influence. It's been used mainly, even overwhelmingly, for harm and destruction. That doesn't have to be. That's our choice here. We can change that.
I would add Chile to that list of countries you just named. Now, when the president says America is back, what does that mean? I can hear late night comics saying it means duck, look out, run for cover.
Well, what Biden meant by the phrase was he was addressing Europe, and he said, well, the only thing Trump understood was how to wreck, how to serve the rich and how to wreck. Those are his policies. So one of the things he wrecked was European alliances. And the Biden administration was saying, don't worry, we're going to rejoin you in the alliances of the past, which don't have a very lovely record, I should say, but we're going to rejoin you in those. So he's saying, we are going to rejoin the Paris agreements that Trump pulled out of. We're going to, he claimed that they would make some moves to renew the Iran nuclear agreement that Trump had destroyed, a few other measures, but basically policy didn't change very much. Some of the more gratuitously sadistic elements of Trump's policies, which had no geopolitical significance, were reversed, but the fundamental policies remain, and in some ways are becoming even harsher. So take, say, the Ukraine. The far right Fox News commentator Tucker Carlson made the comment that should be the leading element of policy. Whatever you think about Putin, maybe the rottenest person in the world, he's not trying to conquer Europe. He's not even trying to conquer Ukraine. He's trying to protect Russian borders from what is, from the Russian point of view, a very serious threat. That's Tucker Carlson, and he's correct. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is sending hawks like Victoria Nuland to try to increase the tensions, to raise the possibility of a confrontation that can be settled by diplomacy and negotiations. They're raising it, as in the case of China, to the level that might lead to a very serious conflict, even terminal war. Now we have to turn to Tucker Carlson for sanity on the topic. I don't know what his motives are. Whatever they are, the comment was the right one. And the fact that that's coming from the extreme right is a terrible condemnation of our political system. Should be coming from the sane liberal center, obviously from the left.
But staying on China, Noam, for a moment, much of the mainstream media, not just Tucker Carlson, is awash in reports about what is called the China threat. Recently, you were on Pakistan's Danish TV, and you said, China is not subordinate to the United States. It cannot be intimidated by the United States. It's not like Europe, and that's unacceptable. If you're the global dominant hegemon, the Mafia Don, basically, you can't accept successful defiance. China's not like Europe, you say. Can Europe be pushed around? Is that what you mean?
We see it every moment. Take the phrase successful defiance. That comes from the State Department in the 1960s, Kennedy Johnson years. They were talking about Cuba and the Cuban threat. Said the threat of Cuba is Cuba's successful defiance of US policies going back 150 years. That means to the 1820s, going back to the Monroe Doctrine, which announced Washington's intention to dominate the hemisphere. It was just words at the time. Britain was far too powerful for the US to dominate the hemisphere. But that was the goal. And Cuba today, 1960s, is successfully defying our goal, which by, of course, that time the United States had succeeded in achieving, as the founders anticipated and said, Britain would decline, the US would increase in power. Sooner or later, John Quincy Adams put it, Cuba would fall into our hands by the laws of political gravitation, the way an apple falls from the tree, and we would extend our domination over the hemisphere. Well, that happened by 1960. Cuba was beginning to defy it, and that successful defiance cannot be tolerated. The United States launched major terrorist wars, which we don't talk about here, but they were very serious. They almost led to a terminal nuclear war, a blockade, severe blockade, country that's small island in the shadow of the United States can barely survive this. It's amazing they survived. Now let's go to Europe and being pushed around. Europe strongly opposes this, as the entire world does. We see that every year at the United Nations, when the General Assembly has a vote on the US embargo of Cuba, the US sanctions and blockade of Cuba. This last year was unanimous, 180-2 against the United States. Two are the United States and Israel. Client state, which votes reflexively with the master. All of Europe strongly opposes it, but they abide by it. They keep to it. Same with Iran. Europe strongly opposed Trump's demolition of the joint agreement in violation of Security Council orders, if anyone cares. Trump pulled out, said, too bad, it's done, then imposed harsh sanctions on Iran to punish Iran for our destruction of the agreement, which they had been living up to. Well, that passed here without comment, not in Europe. Europe bitterly condemned it. In fact, said they were going to find ways to avoid the US sanctions, which they sharply condemned. They then abided by them. They're pushed around again. And this continues. Of course, they have reasons. If you defy the master, the godfather, you get punished. The United States has weapons. One of them is straightforward. You're thrown out of the international financial system, which is run from New York. Well, not a small thing. Afghanistan right now, 1 million Afghans are facing starvation. Well, the United States withholds the funds from the government, which happened to be sequestered in New York banks, according to the press reports, has been pressuring the international institutions to withhold support from them while Afghans die of starvation. I hate to use the word, but that's a small scale example of the fact that you can't tolerate successful defiance. There are many others. You get to China, can't do it. Not intimidated, continue their programs. When I said that about the China threat, I was actually quoting a highly regarded international statesman, former Prime Minister of Australia. He published an article in which he analyzed the China threat, debunked every part of it, which is not very difficult, ended up by concluding the China threat is that China exists. It exists. It's not intimidated, continues its programs. It's even doing really dangerous things. Like, for example, recently it established plans for creating, I think, 1,000 vocational schools in Southeast Asia, Africa, where students will be taught Chinese technology, which means that their countries will then be using advanced Chinese technology. The United States is working very hard to prevent China's technological development and to prevent countries from using Chinese technology. Here, China's going around us, setting up vocational schools where students will be trained in advanced technology, improving their own countries, and indebted to China for doing it. How can a country sink to that level of barbarism? We really have to work hard to prevent it. And the only answers we seem to have are bombs. Somehow doesn't seem like an effective weapon. So there's a real China threat. Plenty of things that China's doing are quite wrong, even abominable, merit severe condemnation, some even in violation of international law, but none of them are a threat. The United States tolerates much worse behavior elsewhere. The China threat is exactly what Paul Keating said, its existence as a rock that you can't move and is going to continue with its policies. It's expanding its programs through Central Asia, incorporating the region within a China-dominated system, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, based in China, includes Russia, which has rich resources and a strong military system, includes India, Pakistan, Iran is now a member, all the Central Asian states, very likely going to include Afghanistan pretty soon. China will begin to exploit Afghanistan's rich mineral resources, try to shift its economy from opium production, which is what it's been under the American rule, to mineral export. Maybe they'll succeed in this, maybe not. Their eye is plainly on Turkey. Turkey's going bankrupt. China will presumably move to expand its already substantial influence in Turkey, move on to extend its influence to Eastern Central Europe, development programs in Africa, even encroaching in South America, US domains. US has been unable to do anything to stop it. It's tried, but about all we're doing is increasing provocation in the seas around China, where China is doing things that are totally improper, but then can be dealt with by diplomacy and negotiations, much as in the Ukraine. But It's not going to be done under the hawkish national security advisors of the Biden administration. That's another thing that has to be changed and fast.
There are multiple mentions of Antonio Gramsci in two of your most recent books, Consequences of Capitalism and Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal. Specifically, the crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. Now, we've talked about that one. The other one, which I'd like you to address, is pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. Talk about Gramsci and his relevance today and the meaning of that quote.
Gramsci was a leading left labor activist. He was Italian in the early 20s, late teens of the last century, very active in organizing left worker collectives, self-directed, kind of the left wing of the international communist Marxist system, the left wing of it. In Italy, the fascist government took over early 20s. One of their first acts was to send Gramsci to prison. The reasons were given by the prosecutor. The prosecutor stated during the trial, "We have to silence this voice." So he was sent to prison. Well, he wrote prison notebooks. He wasn't silenced, though. He continued the work that he began, including some of the things you quoted. Yes, he said in the early 30s, the old world is collapsing. The new world has not yet risen. We are facing morbid symptoms. Mussolini was one, Hitler was another, almost conquered permanently large parts of the world. We came very close to that. The Russians defeated Hitler, otherwise half the world would be run by Nazi Germany. But it was very close. And there were morbid symptoms were clear everywhere. The slogan that he made famous in his journals was what you quoted, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. We have to look at the world reasonably, without illusions, understand it, decide how to act, and recognize that there are grim portents. There are very dangerous things happening. That's pessimism of the intellect. At the same time, we recognize there are ways out. There are opportunities. There are the kinds of achievements that you mentioned before, many more ways of dealing with the crises we face. So we have optimism of the will, meaning we dedicate ourselves to using all the opportunities that are available, and they do exist, and moving on to overcome the morbid symptoms and move towards a more just and decent world.
In these dark times, it's difficult for many to feel there's a bright future ahead. You're always asked, what gives you hope? And I have to ask you the same question that so many others do.
One thing that gives hope is that people are struggling hard under very severe circumstances, much more severe than we can imagine, struggling hard to achieve rights and justice. They don't give up hope, like the farmers in India or the people living in misery in Honduras. They don't give up, so we certainly can't. The other is that there's simply no option. The alternative to giving up hope is to say, okay, I'll help the worst to happen. That's the choice. You can say, I'll refuse to engage in the opportunities that are available. I'll help ensure that the worst will happen as quickly as possible. It's one choice. The other is, I'll try to do as best I can what the farmers in India are doing, what poor, miserable peasants in Honduras are doing, many others like them throughout the world. I'll do that as best I can, and maybe we can get to a decent world in which people can feel that they can live without shame, a better world. So that's not a much of a choice. We can easily make it.
You turn 93 on December 7th. On behalf of Alternative Radio and many people all over the world, a belated happy birthday, Noam Chomsky.
Thank you very much.
That was Noam Chomsky on Optimism of the Will. I talked with him on December 9th. Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist, is America's leading dissident intellectual. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 36th year. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Noam Chomsky on Optimism of the Will, and for his latest books, Consequences of Capitalism and Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go on to our website, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.